From KLCC Studios, this is Oregon on the Record.
I'm Michael Dunn. While most of us have only seen the rainforest on TV, it's still easy to envision it as a strange and menacing place with animals and plants that almost defy imagination. And at the top, sometimes literally, of this diverse environment are the cats, jaguars, pumas, ocelots, and the reclusive margay. It's easy to think of these apex predators as thrown together on the jungle floor and haphazardly going after any prey they can find, but a new study by an OSU researcher suggests that these cats have learned to stay out of each other's way by hunting at different levels on the rainforest floor and in the canopy. You'll hear about that research from the author, and then in the second part of the show, we'll check in once again with a local woman who walked across America to promote civility. Cats are king in the rainforest, but conventional wisdom about how they interact with each other is being thrown into question by a new study from a researcher at OSU. We talk with her next. Ellen DeMitt, a doctoral researcher at Oregon State University, thanks so much for coming on and talking with us.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. Interesting study that you were an author about, wild cats and competition in the rainforest. Talk about what you found.
Yeah, so we've been working with the Wildlife Conservation Society of Guatemala and some other organizations down there to collect the poop samples of four species of wildcats that live in the protected areas in northern Guatemala. The big four cats are jaguars, pumas, ocelot, and margay. And what we found after analyzing their diet is that they seem to be sharing resources in a really interesting way. If you think about the cats as size pairings, so jaguars and pumas paired together and ocelots and margay paired together, we found that the smaller of the two cats in each pairing is eating more arboreal prey, so more animals that live up in the canopy compared to their larger counterpart.
Okay. How did you conduct the study?
We collected scat samples in the parks down there, both by searching for scats visually while hiking around on foot, and also through the help of a dog team from canine conservationists who used their noses to detect the scats. And we collected them and then brought them back to Oregon State University and sequenced the DNA within those scats in our lab here. And then from those DNA sequences, we were able to identify exactly what prey items each cat was eating.
Okay. So I want to pull a quote from you from the press release, and I want you to kind of explain it. It says thus, quote, "The research challenges long-held assumptions about how large carnivores coexist without competitively excluding each other and highlights the importance of vertical foraging stratification." What does that mean? Break that down for us.
Yeah, so a lot of kind of foundational studies on how large carnivores share resources have been conducted in ecosystems like the African savanna, which are, you know, of course have some trees, but largely flat grassland ecosystems. So when you're looking at resource sharing in a system like this, it's pretty two-dimensional with, you know, for example, lions and cheetahs or hyenas using the same resources in different times of day or in different areas in space. But when you add this vertical dimension, this third dimension, if you will, in a forested ecosystem, you have another spatial access along which the animals can partition the resources. So we found that in tropical ecosystems like in Guatemala, this vertical axis is actually a really important and utilized dimension of resource partitioning.
Okay. I wonder if this is too simplistic, but I'm going to try, and you tell me if I'm close or completely wrong, but is part of this an issue of, okay, the larger, stronger cats are going to choose their territory to hunt, and perhaps the smaller cats are going to have to adapt to that, i.e., you know, as I understand it, the jaguar is the largest cat in the Americas. It gets to choose where it wants to hunt, and then a margay, which is much smaller, is going to have to adapt to that much larger predator?
So that's actually not too simplistic. That's an interesting question and something we also tried to highlight in our paper as well. Because we think that, you know, between jaguars and pumas, they're both big enough to kill large prey. And, you know, ocelots and margay are both notably smaller than the two of them. So while, you know, cats that are in the same body size might not be interfering directly with one another so much, it's certainly the case that the smaller cats might be intimidated in some way by the larger cats. And the evidence for that, which we found, was that we actually detected ocelot DNA in the poop samples of both jaguars and pumas. So we know that jaguars and pumas directly predate ocelots sometimes, which, you know, gives them reason, obviously, to avoid one another potentially in time or in space.
Yeah. Let me quickly reintroduce you to the audience, talking with Ellen DeMitt. She is a doctoral researcher at Oregon State University. One of the things in reading about the study, it seemed that this was kind of an aha moment, was pumas predating on monkeys. Was that kind of a very interesting find for you doing this survey?
Yeah, we were very surprised to find that monkeys were the most common prey item used by pumas or consumed by pumas. It's been recorded in other ecosystems that pumas will sometimes hunt monkeys, but this, you know, was kind of more thought of as a one-off thing for those ecosystems, or potentially a part of their diet, but not a very significant part of their diet. So the finding that it was actually the main thing that they're eating was really surprising. And of course, our first question was, how do they actually kill the monkeys? Are they ambushing them at watering holes on the ground? But, you know, we don't really have evidence for that because we had cameras at those watering holes and don't have any pumas or monkeys being ambushed on those cameras. But instead, we think that they must at least sometimes directly go up the trees and kill them. And there's videos, if you go on YouTube, of pumas climbing even palm trees completely vertically, just like, you know, your average house cat would climb up a scratching post or something. Hmm. So they're definitely capable of it athletically.
Okay. Obviously, we all know how much the rainforests in Central America and South America are impacted by humans. And I'm wondering, you know, as they continue to shrink, how do you think that's going to impact both the cat's ability to survive in general, but also this idea of utilizing different segments of the environment to hunt?
Yeah, that's a great question. So more generally, cats and all of these big mammals that live in tropical rainforests have really large home ranges. So they use a lot of square mileage in their day-to-day lives and activities, looking for prey and looking for mates and all of that. So as the intact remaining forest in Central America shrinks, it's going to really constrain the territory sizes of these large animals, especially carnivores like cats, which will inevitably result in fewer of them being able to coexist within these systems. The consideration of the vertical habitat partitioning is also important when you're thinking about deforestation, because oftentimes what happens when forest is cut down is that, you know, there is eventually regrowth if regrowth is allowed, but these super tall canopy trees take, you know, decades to reach that height. So in the newer regrowth forest in areas that were deforested, you're not going to have this canopy level that supports the prey community that is being utilized by cats like pumas and margays. And we can speculate that this might have the effect of potentially intensifying competition among the cats.
Interesting. Our declining of the rainforest, does that also mean that these wild cats that you studied, are they going to have to even diversify their diets more so because one particular species may go extinct and they'll have to find some other source of calories?
Yeah, well, I think that it is potential. There is potential for these cats to adapt to eating whatever food resources become most abundant on the landscape. Even if you look at the diet of cats living in Guatemala compared to cats living in the Pantanal in Brazil, for example, you'll see that they are eating very different things. But there is, you know, one thing that is going to be true no matter which cat population you look at, which is that they need enough large meat sources to sustain the caloric demands of their daily lives. So You know, eventually, if you keep shrinking the rainforest and degrading habitat, you are inevitably going to run out of sufficient prey to sustain a large wildcat population.
Okay. Ellen, my last question for you is this, especially the cats that you studied that hunt so predominantly in the terrestrial environment, in the trees, do they spend the vast majority of their lives there like monkeys do? Or is it that they're just hunting there and then they return to the ground when they're not actively hunting?
You know, these cats are, as you can imagine, really difficult to actually observe. So it's hard to say exactly how much time they're spending in the trees. But we were able to put some cameras up in the canopy to at least capture those instances where they are up in the canopy, or some of them. And we found no recorded videos of pumas in the canopy. So we think that for them, they are largely almost exclusively living on the ground. Ooh. And occasionally going up trees either to rest or to hunt. But margays, on the other hand, we caught several videos of them up in the canopy. And anecdotally as well, they're known to spend a lot of time there, kind of walking along branches and chasing things that live up there. So they might be, of the four cats, the species that is spending most of their time up in the trees.
Ellen DeMitt, a doctoral researcher at Oregon State University, really appreciate you coming on and talking with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about this work.
We've spoken to Esther Tishman when she started her journey to walk across America, and now we'll chat with her as she's completed that journey. Esther Tishman of Liberty Walks, it's great to talk to you. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Well, gosh, I mean, we talked months ago when you started this journey, but just remind folks what you've been doing these last few months.
Well, I have, on July 4th, along with some other folk, I left Eugene and started walking across America to the Lincoln Memorial. And we crossed the Memorial Bridge on Sunday, the Sunday after Thanksgiving, and went up to the memorial. So 5 months later, we made it.
Yeah. I mean, you walked across America, which I guess is one of those great questions is, could you even imagine doing this just a few years ago?
Oh, my goodness. No, I couldn't even imagine doing this like 6 months ago. Really?
Well, tell us, when you made it to the Lincoln Memorial, how did you feel?
You know, I wasn't sure how I would feel, if it would just feel a little anticlimactic after, you know, almost 2,900 miles to just, oh, here I am. But actually, as we were walking across Memorial Bridge and I could see the memorial in front of me, that last half mile or so, I was weeping. I actually started weeping in Arlington Cemetery as we're passing that. It was really powerful, really beautiful. It was actually the worst weather we had encountered on the whole trail. It was rainy and cold, and yet it was beautiful. So there was relief and there was gratitude and mingled joy and sadness about being, you know, at the heart of the Republic. It was a lot. It was beautiful.
What did you do when you got there?
Well, I mean, not a whole lot. I mean, if the weather had been beautiful, it might have been different. It might have played out differently. There were, at the very end, there were 22 of us in that last moment. And, you know, we hit the restrooms.
Okay.
And then a pilgrim has to always do that. And then we climbed the stairs read the inscriptions, the Gettysburg Address, the kind of beautiful inscriptions right over the statue of Lincoln, had some silence, actually. And then we gathered round, and I didn't have anything planned to say. I didn't have anything really planned to do. I just wanted to be there with these folks, some of whom have been, you know, with me the whole way. And to be there, you know, you get to the top of the memorial, and one of the words in the inscription above Lincoln, it says, you know, this temple. And it really, it felt kind of sacred. So just taking that in.
Yeah. You know, you went on this journey, and one of your goals was to promote it, maybe promote civility. And I'd love to ask you, you know, now that you've finished it, did you achieve your goal?
Yeah, I did. I mean, did I promote civility? I don't know. We tried to embody it, and we found in the communities we passed through along the way and the people we met, both our hosts in various communities, but then just on the side of the road, we found just the loveliness of, you know, your neighbors. People were kind. People were solicitous and helpful. People were curious about what we were doing, and people were generous. You know, it was really kind of breathtaking in the generosity and the openness we met. So that was really, really affirming. One of the things I keep saying about this is the microcosm is the macrocosm. You know, the little community of us walkers is a microcosm of the whole big thing. Like, how do you build community at a time when the social media and everything around us is saying, oh, we are so divided. Where does community land in that? It takes work. It's a practice. It's a spiritual practice to work with your own reactivity, your own snarkiness, your grumpiness, whatever the moods are. And so just coming forward each day to meet what's there and who's there. And that was something that we played out on the trip among ourselves, too.
Let me reintroduce you to the audience, talking with Esther Tishman, who's just completed her walk across America for Liberty Walks. Esther, I'm curious, was there something you learned about America on this journey that maybe you didn't know before stepping foot eastward?
I think what I didn't know is that everyone pretty much feels like they're kind of in a bubble and kind of isolated, and that by and large, people welcome the opportunity to break out of their bubble. But again, it's not easy. We don't need to talk through our differences, but we do need to encounter each other in our differences. There's something that we said every morning. We had like a series of kind of affirmations to kind of get us grounded. And one of the things that we said is we earnestly wish to make connections across differences. And making connections across differences doesn't mean overcoming differences. It doesn't mean finding the common ground. It means actually being willing to reach across to people in their different natures and beliefs and community, you know, settings, to really actually be present for each other, to make those, to cross the bridge that divides us. And I come away from this affirmed that that is incredibly important work. That's holy work. That's political work. It's psychologically challenging, and it's 100% worth it.
You know, I've been thinking about you as you've been making this journey, and I'm wondering this. You know, a lot of us have flown across country, perhaps drove across country. You walked across country, which by its very nature is much slower.
Yes.
What was it about going at a snail's pace or a walker's pace that kind of, you know, maybe changed your point of view about travel, but also just about this huge country we live in?
Well, first of all, it is a really huge country. We spent a month walking across Nebraska. It was like, oh, wow, that's a lot of Nebraska. And it was gorgeous. I mean, so life at 3 miles per hour is really life worth living. You know, if we're able-bodied enough, if we can walk on our own 2 feet or roll on our own wheels, you know, slowing down and closing the gap between here and there, between you and me, doing that slowly. You know, the internet, our digital media, the fact that I'm talking, I'm in Minot, North Dakota right now on an Amtrak train, by the way. So I can talk to you, you know, this far away.
Sure.
It's amazing. But it gives us this illusion that we should be able to make sense of things quickly. I walked for 5 months with a guy I'd never met before we started walking. It took me almost all 5 months to realize, oh, you know, I love this person. We're family. We didn't make friendship quickly. And just slowing down meant that even though I spent a month in Nebraska, the landscape of Nebraska and its beauty, its subtlety, the sand hills, is imprinted on my memory in a way that, you know, the sense of flyover America doesn't give you, or drive through the interstate doesn't give you.
Yeah, yeah. people say this next phrase, you know, a lot, but I'm wondering, mm-hmm. you know, you might have lived it, and so I wanted to get your perspective. This idea that mm-hmm. as Americans, we're more alike than we are different. Did you find that?
I think that's true, and it's not true, right?
Okay.
I mean, there's some common ways in which, like, you know, we all experience loss and joy. We all have families. Our families drive us crazy. They nourish us, all the things. We've all probably had more traumatic stuff happen in our lives than we wish we had. Those kinds of things anchor us. We love our children. We love our pets. And yet, you know, our communities are really, by and large, even if you feel like you're living in this totally connected metropolitan area, you are living in a bubble. And that bubble means that you see things in a certain way and you don't quite see what the lens is that you're wearing. That's just the lens you look through. And so the differences are real. Are they... should they stop us? They're enriching, just in the same way that the landscape is different. You know, the farmland, there's corn grown everywhere. That monoculture, that was really clear to me.
Hmm.
You know, corn and soybeans, thousands of miles. But southeastern Iowa is really different from Illinois,
hmm.
you know, is really different from Nebraska. Ranching is different in Oregon than it is in Wyoming. You know, if there are any ranchers listening, they're like, no, duh. you know, ranching communities are also similar. But the differences are real, and honoring them is important.
What's next for you? You're yeah. coming back home. What,
yes.
what might be next?
Well, definitely what's next is building on the community that we've already kind of crafted in the course of this walk. So all these people, and beautiful people I've totally, totally fallen in love with, you know, that I'm texting with and sending photos. Oh, you know, here we are, we're at the Lincoln Memorial. How to keep those connections. So how does Liberty Walks become the basis of a community of people who are really invested in, as you're saying, civility, as I would say, maybe intimacy and love? Like, this is a community of love. How do I build on that?
Esther, it's been great talking with you. Congratulations and much
Thank
deserved
you so
rest.
Much.
And we'll see you when you get back.
Thank you so much, Michael. Such a pleasure.
That's the show for today. All episodes of Oregon on the Record are available as a podcast at klcc.org. Next week, we're going to focus our shows on hunger in our community and state. Monday's show will be with a local author who's done some very personal reporting from her vantage point as a volunteer at a food bank dining room. I'm Michael Dunn, and this has been Oregon on the Record from KLCC. Thanks for listening.